From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. The Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, which imposes certain conditions on a woman's right to abortion. This challenge will test where the Supreme Court now stands on Roe v. Wade and on the rights of states to restrict abortion. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Catherine Colbert, the lawyer who will challenge the Pennsylvania law in the Supreme Court. And we'll talk with Nancy Myers of the National Right to Life Committee. Also today, George Packer talks with us about his new novel, about an American journalist in a third world country covering a new breed of post-Cold War revolutionary. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays a couple of solo works by the first great tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Texas Supreme Court has overturned the state legislature's latest effort to ease the disparities between rich and poor school districts. The system created a number of regional tax districts that merged some wealthier districts with poor ones in an effort to share the wealth. The Texas Supreme Court said that method amounted to levying an unconstitutional new tax on the wealthier districts. The court deferred the effect of its ruling in order to allow the new districts to collect property taxes through 1992, but the justices urged the governor and legislature to come up with a new plan. The Algerian government today took over a mosque in its effort to stifle a fundamentalist Muslim rebellion by the Islamic Salvation Front. From Algiers, Jackie Rowland reports the government even appointed a new chief clergyman.
The Bab El Oued district of Algiers is a well-known fundamentalist stronghold. Weekly prayer meetings have in the past been used as a political platform by the Islamic Salvation Front. But now the new military-backed authorities have acted to take the Bab El Oued mosque out of the fundamentalist network. They have removed the fundamentalist imam and replaced him with one of their own choice. The authorities appear to be tightening the noose around the Islamic Salvation Front by detaining a number of party leaders. These arrests had until yesterday passed off peacefully. But when police tried to arrest two imams on the outskirts of Algiers, they were met by hundreds of demonstrators. A street battle followed and a child was killed by a bullet in the head. This violent incident is likely to increase the tension at weekly prayer meetings tomorrow. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Algiers.
Despite improved U.S. relations with Syria, Secretary of State James Baker has decided not to remove that country from the list of nations alleged to engage in state-sponsored terrorism. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
Following the State Department's annual review, officials said Baker ruled that all six countries on the terrorism list should retain that status. The other countries are Iran, Iraq, Cuba, Libya, and North Korea. Syria was thought to be a possible candidate for removal from the list. It is the only one of the six with which the United States has normal relations. It cooperated with the Allied coalition against Iraq in the Persian Gulf War last year and also with U.S.-sponsored Arab-Israeli peace talks. But officials said Syria continues to provide safe haven to groups that engage in state-sponsored terrorism. Inclusion on the terrorism list bars countries from certain economic and trade benefits, such as the right to purchase certain U.S. technology. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Stock prices rebounded today on Wall Street, helped by stronger fourth-quarter earnings reports from some key components of the Dow Index, including Coca-Cola, Boeing, and McDonald's. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 20 points to close at 3,244.86. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. A dissident union leader announced today that he'll run against United Auto Workers President Owen Bieber in the union's June presidential election. Jerry Tucker heads an opposition group called New Directions, which is pushing to have the union president chosen directly by the membership rather than by convention delegates. Tucker's given little chance to win, but his candidacy is expected to attract UAW members who are dissatisfied with 9 years of Bieber's leadership. Critics charge that Bieber's been too accommodating to the auto industry. The UAW has 900,000 members. The woman who says boxer Mike Tyson raped her began her testimony in court today in Indianapolis. The woman's testimony comes on the fourth day of the trial of the former heavyweight boxing champion. Michael Arnold, member station WBAA, reports.
The 18-year-old woman sounded confident as she told how she met Tyson at rehearsals for the Miss Black America beauty pageant last July. She said Tyson took her to his hotel room and forced her to have sex. The woman said Tyson seemed like a nice man until they got to his room. Then his voice changed and he became violent. The woman's testimony comes after opening statements this morning. The prosecution portrayed her as a good student and a Sunday school teacher who was taken advantage of by Tyson. The defense characterized her as a sophisticated woman who was only interested in Tyson because of his money. If convicted, Tyson faces a sentence of up to 63 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Michael Arnold in Indianapolis.
A Florida jury has recommended the death penalty for Eileen Wuornos, the self-confessed prostitute who's convicted of the murder of one man and accused of six other killings. The jury deliberated less than 2 hours before recommending the electric chair by a vote of 12-0. The recommendation is not legally binding on the judge in the case, who's scheduled to sentence Wuornos tomorrow. Attorneys for Wuornos said the 35-year-old woman suffered from a personality disorder. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A woman's right to abortion was guaranteed by the Supreme Court in the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. But more recent Supreme Court rulings have limited that right. In 1989, in the case Webster v. Reproductive Health Services, the court ruled that states could place restrictions on abortions. Since then, hundreds of bills restricting abortions have been introduced in state legislatures and in Congress. Now one restrictive law, the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, is about to be challenged in the Supreme Court. The challenge is widely regarded as a test of whether the Supreme Court still upholds the principles of Roe. My guest, Catherine Colbert, is the lawyer who will argue the case against the Pennsylvania law in the Supreme Court. She went before the Supreme Court once before in 1985 when she challenged a similar abortion law and won. Colbert is the state coordinating counsel for the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. The Pennsylvania abortion law requires minors to get parental consent or the consent of a judge. Wives must notify husbands. Doctors are required to inform women seeking abortion about potential medical complications. This must be followed by a 24-hour waiting period before the abortion is performed. The ACLU, along with Planned Parenthood, decided to ask the Supreme Court to review the Pennsylvania law. I asked Colbert if that was a difficult decision to make.
Clearly, it was one of the most difficult decisions we've ever had to make. In the normal course of things, ever since we've been litigating these cases since 1980, we've always won at the Court of Appeals. And this was the first time that a Court of Appeals in any section of the country had found that an abortion restriction was constitutional. And therefore, our clients were faced with a very difficult choice. They, however, discussed it very thoroughly and decided that because their rights had been eroded continually over the last several years, and because they expected further erosions not only from the Supreme Court of the United States but from the Court of Appeals, they couldn't guarantee that their rights would be any better protected if we had gone to the full Third Circuit. And therefore, they decided it was time to get the question of whether Roe versus Wade remains the law of the land resolved to enable American women to have it enforced if Roe exists and to exercise their choices in the voting box in the event that Roe is no longer the law.
So what's at stake here? If you win in the Supreme Court, what do you win? If you lose, what do you lose?
I think if we win in the Supreme Court, we will again have clarity on the view that the fundamental right to choose abortion remains part of our Constitution. Roe versus Wade was a decision in 1973 that not only forbid the state of Texas from banning abortion, but also restricted states from enacting roadblocks and hurdles or interfering with the ability of women to make the abortion choice. If we win, we can set about to enforce that right in the states and make sure that some of the 700 laws that have been introduced would never take effect. On the other hand, we don't expect that to happen. We think that the Supreme Court, having been packed by George Bush, is likely to further erode the rights as we know it or even go so far as to overrule Roe completely. And therefore, we have to turn to Congress to ensure that there's a uniform national policy to protect all women's rights.
Are you going into this thinking you're going to probably lose?
Well, Yes, I think I am. I would like to believe that good legal arguments, that justice and freedom win out because it's the right thing. On the, unfortunately, we are facing a court that has been stacked for two current administrations, stacked with judges who met the litmus test that they opposed abortion in order to join the bench. And their influence on the court has shifted from a minority to now a majority of the court.
So the justices can decide now to overturn Roe v. Wade or to just erode Roe v. Wade?
Well, clearly the justices have three options. They can directly overrule Roe, say it's no longer the law of the land. Second, they can erode Roe so significantly, essentially leaving it as a shell, but taking away any of its meat by finding that the states have greater powers to restrict abortion. Or lastly, they could reaffirm Roe. That third option is very unlikely. We don't expect it given this, the composition of this court, but those are the three options. It is, in our view, unlikely that the court is going to directly tell us that they are taking away a fundamental constitutional right. It's not the style of this court. They're much more likely to take away the meat of the decision, to confuse people by saying they're doing something different than what they're actually doing, but nevertheless removing fundamental constitutional protection from women.
So you doubt that they're going to strike down Roe even if they uphold this law?
Well, I think that they are going to overrule Roe, but they will not tell us that that's what they're going to do.
Can you give us a preview of how you're going to argue this case, of what your strategy is going to be?
Well, clearly, we have to present to the court a defense of Roe versus Wade. But ultimately, this court has already acknowledged its hostility to that decision. Nevertheless, we think it's important to present the best defense that we can. We will do so not only in the written form, but certainly in oral argument, in explaining to the justices why millions of Americans rely on constitutional protections for their fundamental liberties. The additional thing I think we need to show this court is how these particular restrictions are really a wolf in sheep's clothing. Because what they do is they sound great, right? They sound very innocuous. They sound like they don't affect any woman's ability to actually obtain abortions. In fact, however, they operate in a very pernicious fashion.
For instance?
Well, let me give you an example. The 24-hour mandatory delay sounds very innocuous. Oh, who wouldn't want a woman to wait 24 hours before making an important decision? Well, in fact, the way it operates is it says that the delay has to occur from the time the woman obtains information discouraging abortion from the physician. That dialogue with the physician only happens at the very end of a long process. Most women have waited sometimes 4 to 6 weeks before getting an appointment with the abortion provider. She's also traveled 200 to 300 miles to find the abortion provider. Requiring her to wait an additional 24 hours makes her wait overnight in a strange location, pay the costs of a hotel, find friends in an area, reveal the fact she's having an abortion to a variety of other people, arrange childcare, essentially increasing her costs significantly. And for most physicians who don't perform abortions every day of the week, a 24-hour mandatory delay really results in delays from 7 to 10 days or longer. So what we're talking about
Because you have to wait 7 to 10 days to get another appointment with
them. That's right. Because if the doctor doesn't do the abortion every day of the week, a 24-hour delay really means the delay until the doctor performs the abortion again, and that may be a week to 10 days later.
Yeah,
let me add something about that is that these regulations aren't intended to protect the woman's health. Most women have decided very firmly that they want to choose abortion before ever calling up an abortion provider. They've discussed it with their families. They understand what's at issue here. They've made a firm decision. But this is intended to discourage that decision.
Well, another part of the bill that you are challenging, of the law that you are challenging, says that a woman has to inform her husband that she is going to have an abortion. What are your objections to that?
Well, again, for the most women, we have no objections. Most women talk to their husbands or their partners about the abortion decision. In fact, you know, if anything, it is men in this nation that are pushing for abortions in many instances, so that the discussion has been held and has been a fruitful one between the parties. What this law does is it forces those women who are unable to talk to their husbands, women who've been battered by their husbands, women who've been victims of marital rape, in fact, who've become pregnant as a result of rape by their husbands, to discuss the abortion option. And while, again, that doesn't sound so bad to some people, if it means risking your life because that husband really is vehemently opposed to the abortion decision, it means that women will either be forced to carry pregnancies to term or forced to face violence at home, an option which we find unacceptable in either case. And I think the other thing about husband notice, and most people understand this very, very clearly, is that the legislature just doesn't trust women to make their own decisions. They're saying, we know better than you. And again, any law that says that the government knows better than women of the nation about personal and private decisions, in our view, is unconstitutional.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Catherine Colbert, and she will be challenging the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court. This is an act which restricts a woman's right to abortion. Colbert is the state coordinating counsel of the ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. We're going to talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is lawyer Catherine Colbert, and she will be taking the abortion issue to the Supreme Court. She will be challenging the constitutionality of the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, which restricts a woman's right to abortion. This is considered to be a very significant case in which the Supreme Court will have to decide where it stands on Roe v. Wade. In your strategy in challenging the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act, will you be mostly focusing on arguing that that this bill violates Roe v. Wade, or will you be arguing for the moral right to abortion and the constitutionality of abortion? And which level will you be trying to reach the judges?
Well, Terry, I think we're going to do both. The first thing we've got to do is to make a compelling argument that this court must reaffirm Roe versus Wade as the law of the land. We need to explain to them how American women have relied upon this fundamental right and why its basic framework, that is, that states must demonstrate compelling reasons for interfering with women's decision-making, is one that has not only worked but has become an important compromise that balances the rights of women against other state interests. We then also must show that the other alternatives, that is, the standards of undue burden, the rational relationship test, which are the ways that the court could permit states to more greatly interfere with abortion, won't work. And lastly, we have to show how these particular restrictions interfere with the health of women. And if allowed to stand, may well send women back to the back alleys for their medical care.
When you present your case to the justices of the Supreme Court, are there specific justices that you're going to be focusing on, hoping that you can sway them to your side?
Well, certainly the entire strategy will be to convince a majority of the court that Roe ought to be reaffirmed. And when you're facing at least four justices who've already said clearly over and over again that Roe ought to be overruled, you really have a very small audience for that point of view. And that's what brings me to the viewpoint that however persuasive my arguments may be, they're likely to fall on deaf ears. President Bush has packed this court with justices who are hostile to abortion, and therefore my arguments will be made, but realistically, we have to turn to Congress and to state legislatures to ensure that women's rights are being protected.
It sounds like you're walking into the Supreme Court thinking you're going to make this argument for history but it might fall on deaf ears within the Supreme Court.
Well, I think that may well be true. But the thing is it's very important whether or not I ultimately win in this particular case for Americans to demand that Roe versus Wade remain the law of the land. Because the court and the justices can't have the last word on this question. They are only one body. They have guaranteed our rights since 1973. But Congress, by passing a federal statute that places the principles of Roe into law, could also be our guarantors. And so we must be realistic. I like to explain it to people. It's almost like a hurricane. We know the hurricane's coming. You feel very powerless in the face of knowing that the hurricane's on its way up the coast. On the other hand, you prepare. What do? You run the water. You make sure that you're ready to rebuild at the point that the court takes away the right or the point that the hurricane attacks. And I think that's what we're doing here. We're saying, I'm going to make the strongest argument I can, but if that argument falls on deaf ears, I'm going to make sure that the rest of the nation understands, A, what's at stake, and B, that they have the power to win it back by turning to Congress.
What could Congress do to guarantee women the right to abortion?
Well, currently pending in Congress is the Freedom of Choice Act. It's a federal statute that would essentially put the principles of Roe versus Wade into federal law and would guarantee for all American women a uniform national standard, a uniform protection of their rights. The ACLU is pushing the adoption of the Freedom of Choice Act, and we would hope that this bill would be on the president's desk as early as this fall so that he would have the opportunity to make it the law of the nation.
What's your most vivid memory of 1985 when you challenged a Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court and won?
Well, that was a very important day for me. It was a very quite an honor to join the ranks of people who've argued before the Supreme Court, and the fact that there's so few women who have done that is a very significant event. Perhaps my most humorous memory is needing to go to use the facilities in the court and realizing that the only bathrooms for the lawyers who argue before the court were male bathrooms.
You're kidding, really?
And having to kind of make my way through the crowds because the women's bathrooms were down the hall. I'm hoping that this time around that has changed and equality has hit the facilities of the Supreme Court. But I think ultimate, besides that humorous memory, I think that the fact that that the advocate or the lawyer stands for so many other people, that you're really making an argument on behalf of people who rely on these precious rights every day, is a very awesome responsibility. And I think that ultimately that's one of the hardest parts of this job.
Catherine Colbert, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Great. Thanks, Terry.
Catherine Colbert will argue against the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act in the Supreme Court. The state of Pennsylvania will be represented by State Attorney General Ernie Priate, who declined our invitation to speak on the show. Nancy Myers is Communications Director of the National Right to Life Committee. The Pennsylvania chapter helped draft the Pennsylvania Abortion Control Act and was instrumental in getting it passed. Myers told me she thinks pro-choice advocates are overplaying the impact this decision could have on the future of abortion.
NARAL and now the ACLU are doing a lot of political posturing on this issue. They're trying to rally their troops. They're trying to get a lot of media hype for it while we're continuing our efforts to stop abortion and remembering that every abortion stops a beating heart. It's our work is even more insistent. Another point to remember about Roe versus Wade and when Roe versus Wade is overturned is that doesn't automatically make abortion not available. What that means is then it goes back to the states. I think that's one of the things that NARAL and now and other groups have deliberately misrepresented that and made it seem as if once Roe were overturned, all of a sudden abortion's not around. All that overturning Roe would do was once again put the question back to the people of each state, and then would begin the long, slow process for pro-life groups of passing legislation. And the status quo is abortion on demand, with very few exceptions. I mean, things like parental involvement laws, no abortion funding in certain states. Other than that, there is abortion on demand, and that's something that the American people don't necessarily want. Americans are mostly in the middle on this issue. They're very much divided, but they're certainly moving in a more pro-life direction. And so they don't want the status quo, so any legislation we pass is progress. And that's going to be the long, slow work once Roe is overturned.
The pro-choice movement mm-hmm. being pessimistic about the Supreme Court upholding mm-hmm. the right to abortion mm-hmm. now, it is already drafting ideas for legislation in Congress mm-hmm. that would uphold a woman's right mm-hmm. to abortion. Are you planning on taking the battle into the Congress, too?
Well, we certainly will be battling their effort, which is the so-called Freedom of Choice Act. Now, the ACLU acknowledges that this bill would go much further than Roe versus Wade and would not allow states to regulate or limit abortion in any way, shape, or form. Parental notice laws would not be allowed. Things like conscience laws, laws that there are in most states that a doctor or nurse does not have to participate in abortion if they themselves are morally opposed to abortion, those laws would not be allowed. And medical professionals would be forced to participate in abortion against their will. That's the impact of this law in Congress. We will certainly fight that, and it would be unwise of Congress to be considering passing something like that, because it's just so extreme. It would once again shut off the debate, just like Roe versus Wade shut off the debate.
Can you give us a timeline of what you see the next steps being mm-hmm. in your fight to end abortion?
Certainly within the next few years, Roe versus Wade will be overturned. But the pro-life movement takes a long view on this. We recognize that it will be a long, slow process, and it's not only passing legislation, but it's changing hearts and minds. And we're also working in that arena. I can't give a timeline in terms of in 3 years, these states will have passed laws. The other side likes charts and graphs and maps, and we don't, because this isn't about politics or posturing. This is about human life.
What penalties would you like to see for doctors mm-hmm. who perform abortions or for women okay. who have them?
Laws before, no, women were not prosecuted before Roe versus Wade, and they will not be prosecuted, and nor will there be laws against women, because in every abortion, there are two casualties, one dead and one wounded. And so we definitely see a woman as another victim of abortion. So in that sense, there are never any penalties considered for women in these circumstances. That's one of the misconceptions out there. Certainly, for people who participate in abortion, the abortionists, most of the legislation being considered are strict civil penalties, so that a doctor really hitting an abortionist where it hurts. Abortion is a very lucrative industry, and these laws would fine them up to $10,000 for each abortion they perform illegally. And some states have considered criminal penalties against the abortionist, but no law has penalties against the women themselves participating in the abortion. I mean, in the women getting the abortion.
How long have you been in the Right to Life movement?
I've always been pro-life, just sort of viscerally. I think there's two sets of people in the pro-life movement, either people who always thought it was wrong to kill unborn children, and other people who were swayed by the arguments in favor of abortion, but once they realized the reality of abortion, that every abortion stops a beating heart, they came to the movement. I've always viscerally been opposed to abortion, and I've been involved in the movement for about 5 years, and I expect to be involved in it for probably the rest of my life.
Nancy Myers is the communications director of the National Right to Life Committee. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. George Packer's new novel, The Half Man, is the story of an American journalist trying to understand life in a third world country. Packer himself tried to do that and only partially succeeded when he served in the Peace Corps. Coming up, George Packer on his travels and his writing. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays two solos by Coleman Hawkins that show why the first great tenor saxophonist remained one of the greatest players in jazz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Pentagon has announced it's ending or cutting back operations at 83 more military bases in Europe and bringing home some 17,000 U.S. troops. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The move is part of the Pentagon's plan to terminate or reduce operations at 492 installations, about one-third of all the military sites outside of the United States. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams says almost all the bases affected are in Germany, and that the move reflects the changing security environment. In the past 2 years, more than 87,000 active duty military personnel have been withdrawn from Europe, along with more than 100,000 dependents and 6,000 civilian employees, roughly the equivalent of a city the size of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
This is not a slow reduction in force. We're bringing people back from Europe about as fast as we can.
U.S. troop strength levels will be dropped from the high of 314,000 in 1990 down to 150,000 by 1995. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Aides to Russian President Boris Yeltsin say that he may propose deeper weapons cuts when he meets with President Bush this weekend. Yesterday, the Russian leader said his country was cutting defense spending by 10%. And halting production of heavy bombers and air and sea-based cruise missiles. On a stopover today in London on his way to New York City, Yeltsin called on Britain, France, and China to follow U.S. and Russian pledges for deep cuts in nuclear arms. However, those three nations turned down his proposal, at least for now. Russian Vice President Alexander Rutskoy has launched a political attack on President Boris Yeltsin, accusing him of mismanaging the Russian economy. Tim Hewell of the BBC reports from Moscow.
In today's Pravda, Mr. Rutskoy denounces the ministers in charge of economic reform as incompetent academics who are conducting an experiment on the Russian people. Poverty, he says, is reaching catastrophic proportions, and he warns that the economic crisis will lead to the breakup of Russia in the same way that it led to the breakup of the Soviet Union. The result, he says, could be the creation of 100 banana republics, each with its own army. Mr. Rutskoy is careful not to make too much direct criticism of the president, but in practice the vice president is plainly trying to build his own base of support among conservative and nationalist forces, particularly among the military. He talks of not giving up an inch of sacred Russian soil, and he makes clear that he supports demands for the Crimean Peninsula to be transferred from Ukraine to Russia.
Tim Hewell reporting from Moscow. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 20 points to close at 3,244.86 on volume of some 195 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. The Space Shuttle Discovery had a smooth landing this morning in a California desert, winding up an 8-day scientific mission. The shuttle and its 7-member international crew touched down at Edwards Air Force Base in California, and NASA officials said the trip was a symbol of future space station work and international cooperation. During its flight, the astronauts studied the effects of low gravity on plants, insects, and crystals. Senator Robert Byrd has announced that he will authorize the issuance of subpoenas in the investigation of the leak of sexual harassment charges during confirmation hearings for Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate leaders appointed Peter Fleming, a special independent counsel, to investigate the leak which led to a series of sensational Senate Judiciary Committee hearings last year. Fleming plans to question the journalists who received information that led to the disclosure of sexual harassment allegations against Judge Thomas. Although attorneys representing the reporters have objected, Byrd said today he will approve the request.
As long as a subpoena requested by the Special Independent Counsel is within the scope of the investigation with which he has been charged and is not otherwise plainly inconsistent with prior determinations of the Senate, it is my responsibility to authorize the issuance of a requested subpoena.
Attorney Floyd Abrams, who is representing NPR reporter Nina Totenberg, says Totenberg will not reveal her source or sources. He says press freedoms under the First Amendment protect Totenberg and her unwillingness to breach her word. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Federal health officials say that there are now indications that the flu epidemic has peaked. Officials of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta say that the flu epidemic is not over and that there are outbreaks in just about every state, however. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. After college, George Packer was interested in an experience that challenged everything he knew. The good news and the bad news was that he found it. He went to Togo with the Peace Corps, but felt so profoundly out of place, he left early. He wrote about the Peace Corps in his memoir, The Village of Waiting, but he saved many of his inner experiences for his novel. That novel, The Half Man, has just been published. It's based on his travels to Africa and his more recent travels to the Philippines. The novel is about a Western journalist named Daniel Levin, who's based in a third world country, not unlike the Philippines. His ambition, which is ultimately fulfilled, is to go to the mountains to interview the leader of the revolutionary guerrillas. Packer went to the Philippines hoping to write articles. I asked him if he saw himself as the same kind of journalist as his main character.
I conceived him more as a daily newspaper reporter who was going to pretty much spend his life writing for newspapers, whereas I went more as a freelancer. You run into a lot of that sort in the third world who were part adventurers, part writers. No, Dan Levin, the hero of the novel, is a fairly conventional American journalist, although in some ways he differs from the others who one meets in that in the country. He sees himself, at least, as being sympathetic to the poor people of Derev Saran. He sort of is on their side. And in some ways, he's a decent man. He does have good instincts. He does care about the poverty there. He does see himself as trying to call attention to injustices. But that doesn't keep him out of trouble, and it also doesn't keep him from doing some bad things.
Well, the leader of the revolution, Fraba Boy, offers an almost existential explanation for young people becoming revolutionaries. He says basically they don't want the weight of their own lives. Give them a gun and show them an enemy, and then they come to life.
That's right. And in the Philippines, I began to feel that it didn't matter really which side the young, the unemployed, the poor, the aimless, the despairing people there joined. Whichever side gave them a larger purpose and gave them a gun, gave them a sense of power, was the side that they would become loyal to, and then they could switch sides fairly easily. It simply mattered that each side recognized their need to feel part of something larger than themselves. And Fraba Boy understands that, and it's quite a shock to Levin to hear that the people who joined the revolution essentially are laying down what Fraba Boy calls the burden of their own life. And Fraba Boy is sort of trying to seduce Levin into doing the same thing, and it's a very seductive proposition because Levin's own life has become quite a burden to him.
How close did you come to interviewing revolutionary leaders on your trips?
I took one trip to the southern part of the largest island in the Philippines with a couple of other journalists, a British journalist named James Fenton and a French journalist. And we spent several days in a guerrilla camp interviewing one of the leading communist guerrillas named Sotero Llamas. And physically and in some other ways, Fraba Boy is based on Sotero Llamas.
So what for you was the most enlightening part of meeting the actual revolutionary leader?
I think the mix of geniality and ruthlessness was really striking. He seemed to be quite a decent man in private life. He He was friendly with us. He treated us well. He was thoughtful. He was witty. He was charming. He wasn't at all the austere, forbidding model of the revolutionary that we have in mind from Vietnam or from China. He was more a sort of Latin-type revolutionary with a bit of flair. And yet, when we began talking to him, we realized that he had sent people to their deaths, had ordered executions, had kept a very tight control over both his own cadre and the local peasants. And it was a bit disorienting to try to make sense of this mix of kindness and viciousness in him.
My guest is George Packer, author of the new novel, The Half Man. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer George Packer is my guest. You strike me as someone who's probably a pretty ambivalent traveler, driven to go, but not always comfortable when you get there. What made you want to join the Peace Corps when you were younger?
I wanted to see the world. I didn't have large idealistic ambitions to feed the hungry. I sort of saw it as the same type of thing that in the 19th century, young men did when they joined the army. It was a way of having an experience that would test me, through which I might find out more about who I am, and that would be an adventure and exciting. And it was all of those things. It was also a lot harder than I expected. The isolation and the moral complications of living in a village and teaching there were at times overwhelming. But it's the sort of experience I can't imagine my life without, and it also got me writing. So it was pivotal in all kinds of ways.
What's an example of a typical moral complication you had to face every day?
One I didn't have to face every day, but that came up for a while, was that I was being ripped off. My house was being entered and burglarized by someone who I didn't know. And I couldn't find out who it was, and the villagers, who were very concerned, didn't seem to know either, although at times I began to sense that maybe they did know and didn't want to tell me, and it aroused all the latent paranoia of anyone living in a foreign culture with a foreign language. And finally, I discovered through one of the little boys who shared the house that I lived in, that it was his older brother who was doing it, a kid who was in one of my classes, who I paid to do certain chores for me. And it also turned out that the entire family had known it was he, had tried to stop him, but hadn't come to me with it. And I think they were protecting one of their own, which they saw as being a higher priority than coming forward and telling me. And it took me a long time to get over the feeling of being betrayed, and an even longer time to realize that it was part of what made their village a great place for them to live, that they had these obligations to each other, which they observed and which were more important to them than abstract obligations like bringing out the truth about a petty crime. I didn't know that until I came back to the U.S. In fact, most of the larger themes in The Village of Waiting didn't come to me until I was back here and able to think in a bit more calm. At the time, I felt as though I had no idea what these people were thinking, what they thought about me, and it took quite a while to get over the shock of realizing that they had been in the know and I hadn't.
Gee, maybe when you came back, you were just rationalizing, huh?
That's what some people have told me. Yeah, I don't want to minimize how tough a thing it was to realize, but you know, we rationalize and we reason, and at times we excuse things away, but at times we understand things a little better. And I suppose I was doing a bit of both.
As a teacher in the Peace Corps, you were teaching a curriculum that you thought was really based on French colonialist teachings. What kind of stuff did you have to teach that you found the most repugnant?
Well, I was teaching English, which in itself was an act of real futility because French was the national language and the language that they were taught in, and most of my students couldn't even speak French. So I was trying to teach them their second European language when they hadn't really mastered their first. And the fact that all of them were bound for the fields when they got out of school made it even more an exercise in absurdity to teach them English, although they seemed to enjoy it. In other classes, they learned weather patterns of Northern Europe. They learned theoretical physics from textbooks that probably were out of date 30 years ago in France. But the most disturbing thing about the schools was the fact that they seemed set up to make the students fail and to feel like failures. It was almost impossible to succeed in their school system. Almost everyone flunked, and hardly anyone passed the exams that got them out of junior high school and into high school. In fact, one of my students, who I still correspond with, has just passed that exam this past year. He wrote hallelujah to me because he had been in junior high school since 1980. So that gives you an idea of how much of an uphill battle it is for them even to get into high school. And it has a real psychological price. They do feel as though they are no good, as though they're inferior. And particularly they feel as though they're inferior to Europeans. And that's really driven home. And I think the government wanted to drive that home to them. It kept them in a state of subjugation, which only recently the Togolese people have begun to rise up out of.
When you say the government, you mean the old colonial government?
Well, I think the new independent government inherited that frame of mind from the colonial government and was perpetuating it. Oddly enough, even though at times it asserted its Africanness, it really hadn't changed much from the oppressive mindset of the colonialists, and it was quite a repressive military regime in which people kowtowed and power was exercised in a fairly arbitrary way, and there was no dissent permitted at all. In the last year, there's been a kind of uprising in Togo along with a lot of other African countries, and it's the most encouraging bit of news from Africa in a very long time.
How have your trips to Asia and Africa affected your sense of yourself as a white American?
That's a complicated question.
Somehow I knew that.
Yes, it's sort of the question. In Togo, what I felt mostly was that I didn't know myself nearly as well as I had thought when I got out of college. I didn't know that good impulses could quickly turn into bad impulses, and that all the goodwill in the world wasn't going to make me one of them. I just could not be one of them. In the end, at night, I always went back to my own house, and it was when I shut my door, it was as though I had pretty much shut out the world I was living in at the time. And they didn't understand me at bottom. I didn't understand them. That didn't mean we didn't love each other, as I did come to love some of the villagers, but understand, no. In the Philippines, it was more of a political experience, and what I found there was that the U.S. had a lot to answer for. In Africa, it's about the last third world place on earth where we're still thought of basically as the good guys, other than in southern Africa. And certainly in Togo, we compared very well to the French. In the Philippines, obviously, that's not true, and among the leftists that I spent some time with, I was constantly having to prove what they called my sincerity. And this is something Levin is up against all the time. People are asking him if he's a sincere man. And that also leads to some self-discovery, such as I don't want to be sincere, or I'm tired of proving I'm sincere, or maybe I'm not sincere. So it advanced some of the self-doubt that Africa had produced, and it made it more political. But again, this sounds a bit bleak, and both of those experiences were vital to me and were enriching, and in some ways were even affirming.
George Packer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
George Packer's new novel, The Half Man, is published by Random House. His Peace Corps memoir, The Village of Waiting, is published by Vintage. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, news today of OMB Director Richard Darman appearing on Capitol Hill to answer questions about the president's proposed budget. We'll also resume our series on the republics of what used to be the Soviet Union, taking a look today at Moldova. It used to be called the Moldavian Soviet Republic. It's a place where a few million ethnic Romanians live, many of them interested in joining with Romania. Also today, we will talk with Mark Okrand, who's a linguist, studied Pacific Coast Indian languages at Berkeley, and then stumbled into a job in Hollywood actually creating a language. The language is Klingon.
Yes. Well, that and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has been listening to a couple of solo recordings by Coleman Hawkins, the first great tenor saxophonist. One was recorded in 1947 and the other in 1962. Kevin says these two solos prove Hawkins stayed at the forefront of jazz throughout his career.
When Coleman Hawkins was a boy, he played the cello before he ever picked up a saxophone, and the cello's resonant tone left a permanent mark on his big and sumptuous horn sound, one of the most gorgeous in all of jazz. In 1944, when Hawkins was turning 40 and had a few years of living in Europe behind him, he began talking about recording a solo saxophone piece inspired by the cello music of Pablo Casals. Hawkins finally got around to it in 1947 or 8, working out the solo for days before he was satisfied with it. He titled the piece Picasso. Picasso is usually looked at as an interesting footnote to Hawkins' career, but it's a lot more than that. In the first place, no one had done anything like it before. You'd have to wait till about 1970 before solo saxophone pieces became at all common in jazz. But with Picasso, Hawkins also settled by example the old debate about the propriety of mixing jazz and classical music, not that folks didn't keep debating it. His voice-like approach to the saxophone sounds indebted to operatic singing as well as cello music. It also echoes the very different vocal quality of the blues, but he blends them so deftly you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. Later, in Belgium in 1962, Hawkins recorded some music for a performance film by his quartet. One of the numbers was another solo piece, pretty much forgotten until it turned up on an album released last summer. That solo was called Dali, as in Salvador Dali, a title which may not have been Hawkins' idea. The performance is at least as remarkable as its predecessor. On first listening, Dali, like Picasso, sounds deceptively casual, even offhand. That's typical of Hawkins, who liked to pretend pieces he'd labored over were trifles thrown together on the spot. Some passages, like that opening sequence, are designed to show off his mastery over the saxophone. But Dolly is a musical exercise more than a technical one. Its stream of consciousness structure resembles that of his earlier piece, Picasso. But in the context of 1962, it resonates against the then new and controversial stuff called free jazz. Like Ornette Coleman's music, it's tuneful and blues-based without being locked into a tightly defined form. In a sense, Hawkins does to the blues what Salvador Dali did to clocks. In 1963, a year after Coleman Hawkins taped Dolly, Eric Dolphy recorded an a cappella alto sax piece, which set the style for solo saxophone recitals by Anthony Braxton, Steve Lacy, and many others. But Hawkins, not for the first time in his career, had anticipated where his younger colleagues were going. He'd been an acclaimed innovator since the 1920s, and he could have settled into a comfortable rut long before this, but he had a restless need to keep changing his music, to make it new. That's how he got to be a great artist in the first place, kind of like Picasso.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. Coleman Hawkins' Picasso can be found on an anthology called Jazz Club's Tenor Sax on Verve. The album Dolly is on Stash Records. Fresh Air is produced by Fred Landerl, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Roberta Shurek, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, conspiracy theories, the extreme right, and the extreme left. We talk with Chip Burleigh of Political Research Associates. He's lately been researching America's richest new party, the New Alliance Party. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.